Okay, good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for coming. I thought, with Hanukkah rapidly approaching, that we would have it would be a really good opportunity to talk. Usually you're talking about texts, particularly, in Tanakh, but we've ventured into Chazal also in this slot, over the last year and a half. I thought this would be a really good opportunity to talk not about obviously the entry in Tanakh for Hanukkah, but the lack of entry. And the reason why that's significant is because if there were no candidate for a biblical entry for Hanukkah, then there really wouldn't be much discussion. But the fact that there is, which we'll see in short order, makes the question of why it's not in Tanakh really that much more interesting. So I want to frame the discussion by, take you through a little bit of a journey that I personally had, about understanding what this book was. And to do so, right, and not surprisingly, it's through the Rambam. As most of my Jewish and rabbinic knowledge kind of developed over the years. So you'll see what I mean in a second. So the Rambam does something when he treats the halachot of Hanukkah that he doesn't do at any other point in the Mishnah Torah. And we'll jump right into source number one. This is, he bunches together the halachos of Purim and Hanukkah together. It's four chapters. The first two are about Purim. The third is really mostly about Hanukkah. And the fourth really gets into where the Rambam chooses to discuss the mitzvah of halal. And then he starts with halal, and then he kind of closes again with the halachos of Neiros Hanukkah. Very interesting why he does that, why he chooses it to do there. It's a discussion for another time. But he opens up Perek Gimel, which is a discussion of Hilchos Hanukkah. So we're doing something that he doesn't do at any other point. He actually tells you a little bit of history. Vayisheni kishamalchu Yavam, right? During the time of the second Beit HaMikdash, when during the Greek Empire, Gazru Gzeros al Yisrael, they instituted edicts on the Jewish people, uvitlu datam, and they actually nullified their religion. Lo hinichu otam la'asok b'Torah v'mitzvot. They did not allow them to perform Torah mitzvot. Upashto yadam b'mamonam. They plundered their wealth. Uvivinoteim. Uvnichnisu laheichel. Ufartu v'pratzos. Betimu ataros. They did all these terrible things. They infiltrated our individual families. They conscripted people to the army. They took slaves. They actually entered into the Beit HaMikdash. And they were mitamei. They made impure that which was most pure. And it was very difficult for the Jewish people, until the Rabbanu Shel Olam actually had mercy on the Jewish people and saved them from them. Alright, so the Rambam, not surprisingly, is putting, before we hear anything about the story, this is all a divine, it's important to note this, that the way the Rambam presents the story, this is all divine salvation. The Gavru Bnei Chashmonai HaKohanim HaGdolim, the Chashmonaim, who were also the Kohanim Gedolim, they were these military rebels. Haragumo Shiu Yisrael Miyadam. They led this rebellion and they actually fought off the Greek army. The Midu Melech Mina Kohanim. And after that, they appointed a new king from the Kohanim. The Chazar Malchus Yisrael Yesra Maasayim Shana Ad Hachorban Hashem. So this is actually historically inaccurate. What the Rambam knew and didn't know about history is, it was always an interesting question. But the Hasmonean dynasty really lasted a little over a century. The way the Rambam is dating it, he's dating it from the point of the Hasmonean dynasty, the beginning, until Ba'isheni was destroyed. But the Hasmonean actually led exclusively, right, with pure, and maybe this isn't what the Rambam has in mind, but the Hasmonean actually led with pure political independence and sovereignty and self-rule for about 100 years, which we'll see in a second. But it was about another 200 years until Churban Bayis Sheni, which has a lot to do again with the geopolitics at the time. When the Hasmonaim basically took over, we'll see it in a second. It was basically the beginning of the decline of the Greek Empire, which led to the rise of the Roman Empire, which is what led to the Churban Bayis Sheni. Shigavar Yisrael al oyveihem the ibdum, when the Jewish people, Bnei Yisrael. Defeated their enemy. They finally beat them off on the 25th of Kislev. This is the Nes of Hanukkah, the Nes of the Pach Shemen. They went into the Heichal of the Beit HaMikdash and they only found one purified pach of shemen. And they only had enough for one day. We know the story. And their nace happened, and they had, and the oil lasted for 8 days. Until they were able to make new shemen zayin. So it lasted 8 days. That Chazal, Be'oto Ador, right? This is actually the time of Chazal. This is the end of the Anshei Knesset HaGadola, but really about a century before the Zugot of the first Zugot of the Mishnah. So we're in a very interesting period in terms of the development of Jewish law and Jewish practice. But Chazal instituted, based on this miracle, that on the 25th of Kislev, we start to celebrate Hanukkah. Yemei Simcha v'Halel, there are days of joy and days of thanksgiving. U'madlikin b'hen anerot b'erev al pitche batim, and where we light the candles, the Hanukkah menorah, in the entrances to our homes. V'chol ayla v'lala b'shmonat halelot, we do it for 8 days. Through this entire holiday, v'yamim elu heina nikrain Chanukah, heina asurin should be hesped. I pulled this off of Machon Mamre. Hesped betanit kimei apurim, and you're not allowed to have eulogies or fasts on the days of Chanukah. Adlakaneret adlakataniruk behen mitzvah midirei sof from kriyat haMegillah, and it's a mitzvah midirabanan to light the candles during this period. Okay, so this is a very the Rambam. What's unique about this is that the Rambam actually gives you a history lesson, and no other point in the Yad, and the Yad is quite large, does he give you a history lesson. He doesn't, at the beginning of Hilchot Pesach, tell you the story of the Exodus, which, by the way, for the purposes of the mitzvah of Sipri Yitzhak Mitzrayim, might have been relevant. He doesn't at the beginning of Hilchot Sukkah talk about a Sukkot Teshuv. He does not talk about it in Shavuot. He does not tell the story of Matan Torah. He really doesn't tell stories in virtually any other place in the Mishnah Torah. And most notably, he doesn't two chapters earlier in chapter 1 of Hilchot Megillah. He doesn't tell you the Purim story. The only place where the Rambam tells you the story of Hanukkah, the story of anything in Jewish history, is at this point. And the question, obviously, or the glaring question, is why? So I open with this. First of all, this is a good introduction to Hanukkah season. But I open with this to basically give this as an introduction to what the Rambam says in source number 2, which is also number 1. I apologize. And this is how I was introduced many years ago to the Book of Maccabees, which we're going to discuss today. Okay, so this is the Rambam's discussion in the opening, in his Hakdamah, his introduction to the Yad HaChazakah. He says something which actually was sparked already in the Rambam's day quite a bit of controversy. If anybody is ever looking for a good laugh, I implore you to read the Ravid's comment on what we're about to read in the Rambam. Because, like many, it's sharp and biting, and it actually is a little, kind of comical as well. Okay, so we're in source 2. Again, this Rambam goes through the history of the Msara, of the tradition of Halacha, and explains how difficult it is to read the Gemara, the Midrashim. And he says, "V'pnei zeh ni'arti chatzni, ani Moshe b'Rabbi Raimon, asfaradi, I, Moshe b'Rabbi Raimon, v'nishati al atzur baruchu, v'nioti b'chol eilu asfarim." I know all these Sfarim really well, I know all these books exceptionally well, I am an expert, the Rambam held of the Rambam very much. Ra'iti l'chaber dvarim hamitbararim mikol elu achiburim. And it was my intention to author a book that actually encapsulates all of these books. Again, he opens this up by talking about the Bavli, the Yerushalmi, and all the Midrashim in Chazal. B'inyan ha'asur v'amutar v'atameh v'atahor im shar dinei ha'torah. I wanted to write everything all together, everything that's mutar, everything that's asur, all of the mitzvot. Kulo b'lashon b'rura v'derech tzara. It is, the Rambam is characterizing what his goal is, which really is a testament to how good of a job he did. His goal was to write something that was easy to understand Hebrew, very organized, very user-friendly. All of those things are an understatement when to describe his magnum opus. Achitehei, we're in the sixth line. Achitehei Torah Shebal Peh, Kula Stura B'fiyah Kol, B'lo Kushiyah V'lo Piruv. He wants Torah Shebal Peh, B'gadol, to be easily accessible. V'lo Zeh Omer B'cho, V'zeh Omer B'cho, not to say, as we know, if you're familiar with Gemara, anybody who's familiar with Torah Shebal Peh, that this Shita, this Masechta, this Daf says one thing, and this Shita, and this Sugya says this thing. He wants everything to be in one place. Ela dvarim berurim korvim nechonim al pi hamishpat asher yitbaer mikol elu achibur v'apirushin hanimtzaim miyemot Rabbeinu HaKadosh ad achshav. Rabbeinu HaKadosh being Yehuda HaNasi. Ad sheyu kol adinim gluim, like we're in the middle of the paragraph, kol adinim gluim lekatan lagadol b'din kol mitzah u'mitzah. Rambam says explicitly he wants the Mishnah Torah to be a work that is accessible both to The simpleton, the layman, and scholar alike, who would din if anybody's looking for a justification for the way the Brisk reads the Rambam. Rambam says it explicitly. He's not just writing it for the average person. He wants the greatest of scholars to be able to plumb this book for its depths as well. We didn't call it for Shetiknu Chachamim Unviim. Klolo Shal Dabar. All right, and he wants to be able to not only do everything in Torah Shabbat, but also everything that's nitkan according to the Nevi'im. Klolo Shal Dabar, or about 2/3 of the way down. Kedei Shelo Yehi Adam Tzarich Lechibur Acher BaOlam B'Din Midinei Yisrael. What's my main under? I should have bolded this. My main underlying goal is that no person require any work anywhere in Jewish life. Other than this, this the Mishnah Torah, the Kabetz La Torah Shabal Pe Kula. He wants this to encapsulate, to include all of Torah Shabal Pe. Ima Takanot, Amin Hagot, Amin Leirot, Shana Asum, Imot Moshe Rabbeinu Ad Chibur HaTalmud. He wants it to include everything from the days of Moshe Rabbeinu, from the days of Moshe's death, and the stima of the Torah until the Chibur HaTalmud, until the Babylonia, until the writing of the Talmud. K'moshe Pirshu Lanu Agaoni Bechol Chiburim Shechibur Achar HaTalmud. This is the Rambam's rare nod to the Gaonim, actually giving them credit for something. The Rambam didn't hold to the Gaonim very much. The Fika, right, he held for the Gaonim of Babylonia, not the Gaonim of the latter day Gaonim of Babylonia, which is why he thought that, one of the reasons why he needed to write this. The Fika, all right, this is the essential thing. We're four lines from the bottom. Karati Shem Chibur Zeh Mishneh Torah. Levi Sha'adam Kore Torah Shebichtav Tchila. He calls this the Mishneh Torah, the review of the Torah. Why? Because a person should write read the Torah Shebichtav at the beginning. He should read the Tanakh. Fa'achar kach Kore Bazeh. And after he reads the Tanakh, he'll read my book, he'll read the Mishneh Torah. V'yodea mimenu Torah Shebal Peh Kula. V'eino Tzarech Lekrot Sefer Acher B'neim. The Rambam says explicitly, and I'll say quite controversially, and already in his time and since then, that he was writing his book as a way to be the only book you'll ever need apart from Tanakh. So why do I open with this? The first time that I read both of these Rambams, all right, I was in ninth grade. I was first beginning my education in Rambam, and it was explained to me, which is I think the standard answer. If anybody disagrees about this being a standard answer, you can let me know. But I would imagine that at least somebody here has heard this before. But the standard answer about why the Rambam uncharacteristically goes into a history lesson when it comes to the beginning of Hilchot Chanukah is why? Because he says the only thing that you need in order to know Judaism is Tanakh and my book. What's missing? The story of Chanukah. The one piece of history that is not recorded in Tanakh that's necessary, according to the Rambam, is the story of Chanukah. And you won't know squat if the only thing that he would do in Hilchos Chanukah is to recite the halachot of Chanukah as opposed to adding a little bit of history. All right, so he doesn't feel the need to write the history of Purim because he has Tanakh, he has the Megillah. He doesn't feel the need to write the history of. He doesn't even feel the need to read the history of the Galut and Gula of Galut Bavel and the Gula of the Aliyah of Ezra and Nehemiah, because that's also in Tanakh. He doesn't feel the need to write Sipur Yetziat Mitzrayim in great detail because it's in Tanakh. The Rambam is saying that there are two books that you need. You need your Tanakh and you need your Mishnah Torah. With those two, you'll be armed with everything that you need to know. That's the explanation that I was always given. Okay, there are other explanations as to why he does this. I'm actually not interested in the Rambam's opinion right now. It's just as much as this highlights more than anything, and certainly was my personal experience, why there's no biblical entry for Chanukah. So, as I was learning, as I was progressing through the ranks in my earlier years, I didn't know of the existence of any candidate, of a potential candidate for a book in Tanakh. I knew that, the standard answer usually is that it happened too late. Purim happened at the time where Tanakh was still being written, and this didn't. And that may in fact be the simplest explanation for why the book that we're going to discuss isn't in Tanakh. But it might not be. And even if it wasn't, I guess we still really need to ask a question about why an exception wasn't made and why there wasn't an entry. Because there was, in fact, a candidate for Tanakh. And not only was there a candidate for Tanakh, the Book of Maccabees, and I call it the Book of Maccabees, right, we'll get more into its nature and character in a minute, but I call it the Book of Maccabees and not Sefer HaMaccabim or anything of the sort, because we actually don't have the original version. It's clear that it was originally written in Hebrew. It's clear that it was originally written shortly after, right? Based on the dating, based on the language, based on its condition. It was written shortly after the Hanukkah story, or part of it at least was. It was written over maybe over a couple of generations. But what is also clear is that it was the author of Maccabees intended for it to be part of Tanakh, intended for it to be a candidate. And scholars, really across the board agree that this was the intention originally, that they'd be writing something that was supposed to be added to the biblical canon. And it wasn't, but at the same time, it was something that was meant to be that candidate. So we're going to point to a number of different things as to why that may be. But the question, which I think is going to cover the rest of today, and Bezrat Hashem in a couple of weeks when we do part two of this, is going to be why that is. What is the Book of Maccabees? Why is it? Why is it that it never really came down to us in its original form, right? It was the original Hebrew version. Maybe it's in a Geniza somewhere that we haven't yet discovered. But the original Hebrew form of Maccabees we do not have. Which is why I quote it from translation and everything and the like. Why is it that that was never added? Okay? I'll give you one more just cute tidbit as to why, as to an indication of why, of the fact that we don't have its original form. How do you spell Maccabee in Hebrew? Okay, Hesi, Mem, Chav, Beis, Yud. Any other suggestions? Okay, so the real answer is that we don't know, right? Now, the popular spelling in Israel is with a Chav, but the word Maccabee doesn't come up anywhere in Jewish literature. It's not anywhere in Tanakh, and since we don't have the original writing of the original version of Maccabees, we only are back translating it from the Greek into the Hebrew, all right? So we're not really 100% sure what the Maccabee is, and what it meant, and what the point was. Yehuda HaMaccabee is known as Yehuda HaMaccabee from this book. As a matter of fact, this is some of the only history that we have of this particular period in, this particular tkufa. But, I once heard this lecture by Yishayo Gafni, who's a famous historian in Israel, actually lives next door to to Dina's grandfather, and Chavati Gonim, in Israel. So I met him on a couple of occasions. So Gafni made this point. He said he was once asked this question at he said he was put on a panel in Israel on TV around Hanukkah time. And he was supposed to be the middle, and then they had some guys supposed to be politically on the right, and they had some guys supposed to be politically on the left. And they asked everybody how to spell Maccabee. If you spell it with a chuf, it refers to a hammer, right? And basically, the point then is the title that Yehuda HaMaccabee gave himself, or that was given to him, was that it was connoting his great strength. And if you spell it with a kuf, it connotes, I actually don't remember what the point was, but something more religious. It had more of a divine connotation. And then they asked Gafni, and so the guy on the right said that it was the kuf, and the guy on the left said it was the kuf. And then they asked Gafni, and he said, I have the luxury of not having to answer this question because we actually don't have the original Hebrew version. So, pass. So it's a cute story. In Israel, this is actually a little bit more of a little bit more common knowledge. It's just an indication of how we don't have the original form. So I want to talk about the book. But before we get into the text, and I really, other than just the background, I just did the first three chapters of 1 Maccabees. So I want to look at some of the text itself. I want to just go through our timeline format and see what we're talking about in terms of the context of the history of the Greek Empire and what we're looking at in terms of the Hanukkah story. So, about 130, 40, 150 years before the Hanukkah story happened, this guy named Alexander the Great, who was the heir to the throne of Macedon, takes control. We're on page 2 over here. He takes control. He inherits the throne after his father is killed. All right, this is in 336 BC. And he ascends the throne, here a newly appointed king, Macedon. He then goes on a 10-year campaign, right? The thing of Alexander the Great is recognized as one of the greatest military minds and, one of the greatest military generals in the history of warfare, and really the history of warfare, right? Up there, Napoleon is given this type of accolade as well. So he took over, he was only 20 years old, and he was both a political genius and he was a military genius. He was able to consolidate power, he was able to rally people around him. Generals who were much more older and much more experienced than him were able to flock to his leadership. And because of that consolidated power and because of that brilliance, he went on a 10-year campaign in which he conquered most of the ancient world. most of the occupied ancient world, Asia, basically from North Africa all the way to India. Right? And you'll see, if you flip the page to page 3, you see the extent of his kingdom. Egypt, over here, the map is in a different language, that's why the labels don't really make any sense, but you recognize the area. So this is the Mediterranean. So he had from Egypt, and the thing he said that he didn't invade the Arabian Peninsula, which is actually a very interesting decision, not for now, but it's one of those questions that you always have to wonder what would have happened if the Arabian Peninsula was invaded for, 1,000 years before Islam, and was given 1,400 years before Islam and was Hellenized the way that the other parts of the world were. What might have become? But he went from Egypt and he conquered basically all of southern Europe all the way through India. This is the largest empire in the ancient world. And so he conquers this over a 10-year period. To be able to have accomplished this much in such a short time is really shocking. And he dies as a young man in 323 BCE, only about a dozen years after he takes over the Macedonian Empire. As a result, all right. So he had this. Alexander had an ideology that he was pushing, not just a military conquest. He actually wanted to Hellenize areas, right? Hellenize being bringing Greek culture, bringing Greek thought, philosophy to these lands as he conquered them, and that's why he set up like these little outposts. He was established cities. And he tried to infuse the cultures that he invaded with all of these with the ideology of the Macedonian Empire. He was an acolyte of the greatest minds at the time, right? And he was only 20 when he took over the throne, and as a result, he actually was still very much under their influence. So, what happens though is that in his premature death in 323 BC, he's still in his low 30s. All right. Now, whatever happens when you have, all right, and this is not this is a story that unfortunately we know of. What happens when you have a dictatorship? What happens when you have a leadership of any institution, big or small, that really flows through one person? Its identity, its nature, really is entirely because of one person. When the person is gone, everything kind of is haywire, right? One of the most masterful strokes of brilliance that the United States had 250 years ago was not John Adams famously said that they wanted to create a republic of laws, not men. They wanted to create a republic of ideals and ideology. They wanted to create a republic of laws that would actually outlast any of the founders, which it did, right? And the final piece of this puzzle was that Washington, who was that larger than life figure who started the republic, he backed away twice, really. He backed away and refused to continue the republic. And as a result, this ideology and this system that the founders had put in place was allowed to come to fruition. Because that larger-than-life figure wasn't there, and the rule of law was able to take hold. That didn't happen in Hellenized Macedonian Greece. You had this one larger-than-life figure, which was the typical of the ancient world. You had one emperor, and the emperor was the only person that was able to command that type of devotion and that type of leadership. So once he was gone, it wasn't able to sustain itself. So as a result, the empire ends up splitting into four different sections. You'll see over here they're actually color coded: the green, the orange, the yellow, and the blue. All right. For our purposes, we'll just talk about the Seleucid Empire and the Ptolemaic Empire. That's the blue and the yellow. And as you'll note, where is the dividing line between that, right? And this has been the unfortunate case throughout the history of Eretz Israel. I think that actually has a lot to do with what God had in mind, with it being this being the land that's the land bridge from Africa to Asia, and basically the middle of everybody in the world's conflict. We land right on the dividing line. This was the case with the Babylonians and the Persians as well. This is the case in Tanakh between the Babylonians and the Egyptians. Eretz Israel is always in the middle of people's problems. So as a result, Israel now is in the middle of what becomes a lot of political jockeying that happens for the next several centuries during the outgrowth of what was the Alexandrian Empire, and it ends up getting split into two. Okay, so that's where we are. I know the ins and outs of the next, you know, the next 150 years, I didn't really think was necessary for our story. In 175 BCE, and Antiochus, whom we know as Antiochus, and the scholars usually refer to as Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, all right, he's our bad guy. He's as my son Tzvi would say, he's the bad king in the Hanukkah story, all right. Zachashverosh is the bad king in the Purim story, and his power is the bad king in the So he's the bad king in the Hanukkah story. So Antiochus the Fourth Epiphanes, he ascended the throne of this Cuculean Empire, and Jason, who was the brother of Honio, who was the Kohen Gadol, he bribes Antiochus to install him in place of his brother. So there, the political jockeying that's taking place in the Macedonian Empire, in what the former Macedonian Empire, at this point in Eretz Israel, the corruption basically extends to the high priesthood, which was the de facto leadership. When we were talking about in the Zionism series that we did last year, when we were talking about the context of the development of the Torah Shebaal Peh, we were talking about all these events, but from the perspective of the priesthood and the Anshei Knesset HaGedolah and how the Mishnah basically came to be. Right now we're focusing not on the history of Torah Shebaal Peh, but on the surrounding history that affected the Torah Shebaal Peh. The Gemara talks about this in a couple of places, that there was extreme corruption in the Kahuna Gadola in the latter part of the Bayit Sheni period. So this is in fact recorded. Okay, well, I put the few sources that I actually have here are from Maccabees, not surprisingly, because for this 100-year period, it's really some of the only historical sources that we have. Scholars rely on these books heavily. Okay, so at 175 BCE, Antiochus takes hold, and has diplomatic relations, as did the empire, every emperor in this at this point, every leader of this area, with Eretz Israel and with the established Jewish leadership. Okay, so Antiochus now is on one of the endless military campaigns in Egypt. Right, and this is in 167 BCE, right, 10 years or so years after he takes hold of the throne. Antiochus is told of an attack on Jerusalem that deposed his anointed high priest. So he had appointed Jason, right? I forget. He has a Hebrew name, but the Hebrew name is not really Hebrew because it's coming from 1 Maccabees. I forget what it is. Anybody remember? Yason, something like that. So he hears that the person that he had appointed as the Kohen Gadol is deposed, and he gets furious. And this is actually what sparks his whole invasion. He leaves Egypt and took Jerusalem by storm, and he gives his men orders to kill, to enslave, to pillage, and this actually began the formal process of the Hellenization of Yerushalayim. Right, that 167 BC, which basically means that under Greek rule for 150 years, we were still a client state of the Greeks, but we had some measure of at least religious independence. This was the point. This was the point. What we did was we ticked off Antiochus by taking the vassal leader that he had appointed, by deposing him. That's what ticked him off and got him to, right? You know, this was not the kind of guy that you wanted to cross. Yeah.
Who did the attack on Jerusalem that deposed his appointed high priest? The Jews?
It was an inner Jewish rule. You have to understand, the Kohen Gadol was corrupt. There was somebody else who was the Kohen Gadol, and he was removed from power by a foreign pagan ruler.
So who are the other players that we would know of at this time?
So this is what so the other players that we would know of, we actually don't really know of. Uh-huh. The people that we know from this historical period are all Chazal. Right? During this period is the birth of the Mishnah. Is the birth of the Shimon HaTzadik, Mishiyari Knesset HaGedola. Right? This is what we discussed last year in the period when we were discussing the development of Torah Shebaal Peh. We Chazal, right? And you look at the history, the little history that is laid out in the Mishnah, pays very little attention to the surrounding Hellenizing culture that's going on. And they pay such little attention. We have information, right? We have literature from the times of the Mishnah for 100 years before at least 100 years before the Beit HaMikdash is destroyed. And there's nary a mention. There's very little mention of
the Kohen Gadol or the second.
Okay. This is the last piece of history that we have of the Beit HaMikdash.
And Josephus wasn't around at this time.
Josephus is 100 years later. He's at the time of the Romans, 150 years later.
Uh-huh.
Okay? He was a Rome, he was a Judean Jew who ended up being imprisoned in Rome and then being led out of Rome to be an emissary between the Roman Empire. But he doesn't come along for another 150 years. Josephus does talk about the history of Hanukkah, but he's talking from a century and a half later. Two centuries later. Okay, so what we're dealing with now is a lot of infighting within the Jews because they are furious that there are some good Erlich Yidden out there who are furious that their religious central point, central focal point, is actually being governed by some foreign pagan ruler, which you could imagine. Imagine if Governor Cuomo came along and said that he was going to appoint the rabbi of our shul, and the guy that he picked was a graduate of HUC, right? But imagine something like that happens.
So who is the Sicarius? You hear about the
sectarians?
SICARU, something like that. They were the zealots. Were the zealots at this time?
So this is who we're going to. I mean, there were different zealots at different points. What we're going to see is that really what the Chashmonaim were. Matisyahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonai Ubanav Kesham Demachos Yevan Arshalam Chay Israel. They were originally a band of rebels. They were originally a band of people protesting, make America great again, make Israel great again. And it basically crossed the line for them, and that's when they took up arms.
When is Yochanan ben Zakkai? When does he go and tell? Is this the
Yochanan ben Zakkai is a story of the Roman Empire?
Okay.
So this is where this gets confusing. The Roman Empire is starting. I actually left it off the map. The Roman Empire during this period is over here, right in Italy, in blue, and it's starting to grow. As Alexander's empire starts to contract because it's not unified anymore, it takes 150 years for it to really dissipate. But that's the point where Roman rule starts to grow. And Rome eventually takes this now Hellenized culture in the Middle East and they take hold of it. That's Yochanan ben Zakkai, the end of the Mishnah period, or the end of the Beit HaMikdash period, which is the beginning really of the Tanaic period. That's the period of Yochanan ben Zakkai. Okay. So that's kind of the history that we're in. So 167 BCE, that's when he comes and he sacks Jerusalem. Now, this is going on for about a year, and in 166, after the death of his father, Matityahu, right, Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol Chashmonai, this is, I'm over here, alright, this is in 166, Judas Maccabeus, Yehuda HaMaccabee in Hebrew, again, we're not really sure how that's spelled, he leads a revolt against the Seleucid Empire. And after a war of several years, he actually does achieve political independence for the Jews for the first time in centuries. They don't know political independence until 100 years before Churban Bayis Rishon. Right? So it's been the last century of Churban Bayis Rishon, the entire 70 years of Galus Babel, and then the first really 250 years of Bayis Sheni, they were all under foreign rule. First it's the Persian Empire. And eventually it's the Greek Empire. And now, what was so significant about this, and the Rambam actually, is very limited in what he tells you about the story. He does choose to tell you about the fact that they achieved political autonomy for the first time in centuries. And that basically stayed the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash for another 200 years. All right, so 166 BCE is one of the most momentous times in the history of, the political history of the Jewish people. I put here, right, so the period of the Hasmonean dynasty, 166 BCE to 63 BCE, right, this is 100 years, almost 100 years before Churban Bayis Sheni. Why? Because that's 100 years until Pompey the Great, the consul of the Roman Republic, and this is in 63 BCE, after conquering the Pontic Kingdom, which is what is modern-day Turkey, is asked to intervene in a civil war in Judea over the Hasmonean monarchy. They spent the next 100 years of infighting without there being a clear monarchy, right? This is not the Malchut Beit David. This was basically a faux monarchy that they created, the Hashmonaim. In that context, they were the ruling body, right? Their general area that was the ruling body. It would be like Puerto Rico. Right? Not forgetting the fact that it's like that's actually a U.S. territory. Imagine Puerto Rico asking the U.S. to intervene. Right, because they're nearby, and they're the big military rule. So there was a big spat going on, infighting in the Hasmonean dynasty, and they asked Rome to intervene. And as a result, Rome came in and they made Judea a client state. So the same way that they were a client state of the Greeks, 150 years earlier, they are now a client state of the Romans. That 100 years before Churban Bayit Rishon, that's what ended political autonomy for the Jewish people. Okay, so this period of 166 BCE to 63 BCE, all right. So this is the first 100 years, right, of Hashmonaim. Then there was another 100 years that we were living under Rome. Okay, which basically things deteriorated worse and worse and worse. A story for another time. But that was the period. That was the last. That 100-year period was the last 100 years. Until 1948, when you think about it, just how momentous that Hakamat HaMdina was. That was the last 100 years, 166 BCE, right, or 63 BCE, was the last time in that the Jews actually had political autonomy over themselves. I mean, maybe a couple of minor exceptions, but and none of those minor exceptions really were full political autonomy. So the fact that this is, because for the Tzionim in us, it actually is an important point to make, but when we're discussing the period that we're in, the period of Hanukkah, so that's really significant. Okay, so you have this map. The map is the general idea of where we are and how we're stuck in the middle of this, right? The middle of this tinderbox of the four competing kingdoms in the wake of the death of Alexander the Great. Okay, so that now we come to our book, the Book of Maccabees. It's one book that was split into two, as was Shmuel, as was Malachim, as was Divrei Hayamim. Okay, this is the best translation of it from the oldest version that we have, which is the Greek. We don't have the original Hebrew. It's the Anchor Bible. If anybody's interested in borrowing it, I got this in graduate school when I first started tackling these books to begin with. I was talking to Aaron Kohler, Professor Kohler over Shabbos, and the point that he made, he does this for a living, so the point that he made to me about this was that, it's so interesting. There are several books that are not part of Tanakh that are called the Apocrypha. Okay, I first learned this stuff with Dr. Schneier Lyman in graduate school, my first iteration in graduate school. So Dr. Lyman said, and Aaron said yesterday as well, nobody's trying to put these things in Tanakh, and nobody's even necessarily ascribing divinity to them. But these were books written by Jews about Jewish life and Jewish culture in the land of Israel, and nobody even knows about them, let alone reads them. So if anybody's interested, okay, I'm certainly not ascribing religious significance to any of them, right? They were not part of Tanakh for a reason. Why they're not, we can discuss. But if anybody's interested, right, there's the list of them is on the back, the Apocrypha. They're all Jewish books, and they're kedai to give a look. If anybody wants to borrow, I'm happy to give it to you. Jonathan Goldstein, who's a scholar who did the Anchor Bible series on Maccabees, he actually has about 150 pages of an introduction, which discusses a lot of the history in detail, the history that we've been discussing, and goes into a lot of these ins and outs. Very, very, I would argue, if you're, for the students of history, very important stuff to know. Let's get into the text itself. I give the original, the English, because everything is in translation anyway. Right? I would, if any of us spoke Greek, I would put the Greek in. But we don't have it, so I have the English translation. Okay, I want to just zip through, right? We'll take the last 10, 15 minutes that we're going to take today. And I want to zip, I'm not going to read all of this. I want to zip through some of this stuff and point out to you, at least just to whet your appetite, to the question of why this book was not put into Tanakh. Okay? And you'll notice, alright, I want you to notice, as we're reading through some of this, I want you to notice why it should be a candidate and why it shouldn't be a candidate. Things about this that sound like Chumash, right? We're not used to reading Chumash or Navi in English so much, but you'll things that sound like Chumash and things that maybe seem a little bit, a little bit not so Chumash or Navi-ish. Okay, opening up, chapter 1. This is a bit, you'll see, they're a bit close. After Alexander, son of Philip the Macedonian, who came from the land of Kittim, had defeated Darius, king of Persians of the Medes, right? This is a very Judeo-centric narrative. For Alexander, it was an important military victory, but when he defeated Darius, the king of the Medes, right? The Persian Empire, yeah.
So is Darius the one from the Esther story, her son?
No, it's a much later iteration of basically, like King Queen Elizabeth or King George. All right, or Louis, Louis of France. It was a name, you get named after your Zaidi. So the Purim story happens. You realize the Purim story happened during the interregnum between, when there was no Beit HaMikdash. That was right in the 6th century BC.
So after 586 on towards zero.
Yeah. So if you're looking at it, so if you see the date that we're talking about, Alexander only took power in 336. Right. So it's a couple of centuries later. Okay, so it zips over a lot of this history, right? Because you'll notice it opens up about Alexander the Great. The Hanukkah story doesn't happen for 170 years, but that's 150 years. Okay, so he came from the land of Kittim and defeated Darius, king of Persians and the Medes. He succeeded him as king. He had previously become king of Greece. All right, so for the Judeo-centric narrative, nobody cares about what's going on in the rest of the world. We care about who's in charge of our land. It was the Persian Empire, now it's the Greek Empire. So his defeat of the Persian Empire is what's said first. He fought many battles, conquered strongholds, and put to death kings of the earth. He advanced to the ends of the earth and plundered many nations. And when the earth became quiet before him, he was exalted and his heart was lifted up. Alexander, in Jewish history, right, already we see this in the Gemara, was not a bad guy. All right? He actually believed in a certain degree of religious autonomy. He believed in a cultural, in a cultural arm that he was to extend to everybody. But at least in the Jewish history's depiction of Alexander the Great, is he was a good guy, which is why Ad Ayom we have Jewish names, right? Jewish people named Alexander. I have a nephew, Alexander Zev. All right? It's not uncommon at all. Verse 4. He gathered a very strong army and ruled over countries, nations, and princes, and they became tributary to him, right? Which is what happened. The Judea, Eretz Israel, became a client state of the Macedonian Empire. After this, he fell sick and perceived that he was dying. So he summoned his most honored officers, who had been brought up with him from youth, and divided his kingdom among them while he was still alive. Now, there's a historical truth to this, but in Maccabee's telling of this split of the kingdom, it was very much alachatchila. And they end up fighting with each other, ends up being a betrayal of the Alexandrian model, the Alexandrian wish. The fact that they become opponents, which is what the Jews end up getting stuck in the middle of. Verse 7, and after Alexander had reigned 12 years, he died. Then his officers began, verse 8, then his officers began to rule each in his own place. They all put on crowns after his death, and so did their sons after them for many, many years. All right, and they caused many evils on the earth. So in the telling of Maccabees, Alexander the Great was great, and his Talmidim were not great. Verse 10, from them came forth a sinful root. Antiochus Epiphanes, son of Antiochus the king. Antiochus he's really Antiochus the fourth, but his father, his name is also Antiochus, and he had been a hostage in Rome. He began to reign in the 137th year of the kingdom of the Greeks. Right? In those days, lawless men came forth from Israel and misled many, saying, let us go and make a covenant with the Gentiles round about us. For since we separated from them, many evils have come upon us. So in the telling, right, notice, in the telling of Maccabees, what's going on? There's a bad guy that comes to power, this guy Antiochus the Fourth, Epiphanes. But it's not who initiated the problem. He came into power, but it seems like from the telling that we would have been fine if we stayed by ourselves. But what happened? Right, it's these darn Yidden who don't know how to stay out of trouble. Right, they're the ones who entreat to Antiochus, and that's what gets us into the problems. They want to be political allies. Right, so this verse 12, this proposal pleased them, and some of the people eagerly went according to Gentile custom and removed the marks of circumcision and abandoned the holy covenant. They joined with the Gentiles and sold themselves to do evil. So in the telling, in the original telling, and this is not consistent throughout the book of Maccabees, but in the first telling of what's going on here, the removal of, right, which is something that you actually can do, it's usur, it's spoken about in Halacha, the removal of your bris milah, right, by this kind of regrowing of your foreskin, and this casting away of Jewish tradition, this was all initiated by Jews. 16, when Antiochus saw that his kingdom was established, he determined to become a king of the land of Egypt, that he might reign over both kingdoms. So he invaded Egypt with a strong force, with chariots and elephants and cavalry and with a large fleet. Right? Think about how this telling is glossing over real whole swaths of history, focusing on these little things that are relevant to how they are to Jews. It sounds like you're reading Malachim. It sounds like you're reading Divrei Hayamim. Right? You can just imagine reading this on the English side of an English Hebrew Bible. 18, he engaged Ptolemy, king of Egypt, in battle, and Ptolemy turned and fled before him, and then he war, wounded, and fell. Right? So this is the Egyptian Seleucid. I never remember how to pronounce the words. This is one of those things that you just read. Right? And they captured the fortified cities in the land of Egypt, and he plundered the land of Egypt. 20, after subduing Egypt, Antiochus returns in the 143rd year, and he went up against Israel and came to Jerusalem with a strong force. Now, the verse that I quoted in the timeline is from 2 Maccabees, right? It's much later in the book. But here it doesn't talk about the deposing of Jason. It doesn't talk about Chonio. It just talks about this. You're just saying that he came along seemingly out of nowhere, and he went up against Israel and attacked Jerusalem. He arrogantly entered, verse 21, he arrogantly entered the sanctuary and took the golden altar, the lampstand for the light, and all its utensils. Right? Does this sound familiar to you? He took the kelim of the Beit HaMikdash, right? 22, he took also the table for the bread of the presence, the cups for the drink offerings, the bowls, the golden censers, the curtains, the crowns, and the gold decoration on the front of the temple. He stripped it all off. Right? He went in and basically took was for him. It had absolutely no religious significance. He took all the valuables. He plundered the Mikdash. He took the silver and the gold and the costly vessels. He took also the hidden treasures which he found. 24. Taking them all, he departed to his own land. He committed deeds of murder and spoke with great arrogance. Okay, so this is not a favorable to Antiochus. 25. Israel mourned deeply in every community. He didn't destroy the Beit HaMikdash, he just plundered it. Right, Israel mourned deeply in every community. Rulers and elders groaned. Maidens and young men became faint. The beauty of women faded. Every bridegroom took up a lament. She who sat in the bridal chamber was mourning. Now I want you to think about the way Chazal describe Avelut over the Beit HaMikdash. You think about the Gemaras and the Mishnayot, the Gemara in Masechet Tanit, the Gemaras in Masechet Gittin, about what happens in the wake of the actual Churban. This sound is very resonant. All right, people, all of a sudden beauty was gone from the world. People didn't even look pretty anymore. Nobody wanted to be happy. Nobody was all right. The Avilitzion, the people that were just focused solely and preoccupied with the destruction of the Mikdash. This was the zeitgeist of the time. It was the national mood. 28. Even the land shook for its inhabitants, and all the house right next page, and all the house of Jacob was clothed with shame. Okay, so you get the idea. People are coming along, and in a second we actually have the abandonment of halacha, right? We skip to 44, and the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem. All right, this is Antiochus sending letters to Jerusalem. So we're at 44 right now. Into the cities of Judah, and he directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary. You realize that the mourning that's been described didn't actually cause function to cease in the Mikdash. It just meant that it was plundered. We didn't have a menorah anymore. We couldn't light the menorah. But there was still, you know, the stone, bronze, mizbeach was still functioning. Right? But then came along all these letters saying, you're not allowed to have karbanot. You have to have sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary. Right? You're going to have alcohol, which was prohibited, to profane Sabbaths and feasts, to defile, 46, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, 47, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and unclean animals, 48, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. All right, this is not just a question of regrowing your Brit Milah, but actually no longer doing. All right, and these are the takanot that we're familiar with, which is famous in the Hanukkah story. Right, Shabbos, Milah, and Rosh Chodesh. Right. So they were to make, right, which by the way was another political move. You take away the Jews' ability to govern their own calendar, then their entire system of law, entire system of calendar, their entire system of holidays, everything falls apart. That's why Rosh Chodesh was an important political move as well. They knew what they were doing. To leave their sons and circumcises, they were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane. Everybody should recognize, by the way, that all the knowledge that we have about Hanukkah is coming from here. Right? There's a couple of lines in Chazal. There was a tradition about this, but you can guarantee that the Tanaim and Amarim were familiar to some degree with this text. If they didn't have the text in front of them, they had some sort of summary of this text. Or their father had this text, their grandfather had this text. And this is how most of the knowledge of Hanukkah has really come down to us. The Gemara that talks about, or the Gemaras in Shabbos that come along, it's a Braisa. The Braisa was probably written at least a century after the Hanukkah story. This was written, right, after the Hanukkah story, but at least more contemporaneously than what we have. So it's not, again, whether it's part of Tanakh or it's not part of Tanakh, this is an important part of Jewish history that's being penned here. Right? They were 49. They should forget what was part of Antiochus' letters. They should forget the law and change all the whole kingdom and all the ordinances. 50. And whoever does not obey the command of the king shall die. Right? 51, in such words he wrote to his whole kingdom, and he appointed inspectors over all the people and commanded the cities of Judah to offer sacrifice city by city. Okay, so this is the story that we're familiar with. Antiochus comes in, he doesn't really tell you about the political corruption that caused him to come in here, that's described in 2 Maccabees, and they're in the second version, but he comes in, lays waste to the city, plunders the Beit HaMikdash and immediately gets in at the core aspects of religious observance. And doesn't want anybody following anything. Let's go to chapter 2. All right? And this is where our hero starts to. Right? Think about this story in terms of Shmot, Perek Aleph, Perek Bet. Perek Aleph setting up the tragedy of Mitzrayim. And then Paro comes along and says, right, they might wage war against us, they've become too numerous, so we have to have a genocide of them. And then Perek Bet is with the birth of Moshe Rabbeinu. Right? Think about the beginning of Megillat Esther. Setting up the scene of the first two prakim, which set up the whole scenario of the Jews' life being threatened, and then comes along the paragimel, which is Mordechai Adat Kol Asher Na'asah, and then the beginning of the salvation. Think about biblical stories. This is exactly the type of thing that we were reading. Parak Aleph, chapter 1 of Maccabees, sets up the tragedy, and chapter 2 is now our hero. In those days, Matthias, the son of John, son of Simeon, a priest of the sons of Yorim, moved from Jerusalem and settled in Modi'in. All right, Modi'in, the area that now is a big city, but it was an area back then. He had five sons: John, surnamed Gadi. All right, John Gadi. This is where the name comes from, if anybody was ever curious. All right, Yonatan, Simon called Thassi. All right, this is Shimon, Judas called Maccabeus. All right, and in the telling of number five, Eliezer called Avaran, and Jonathan called Aphis. And in the telling of Maccabees, all right, Maccabeus, all right, Judah Maccabee was his nickname. All right, every one of Matityahu ben Yochanan Kohen Gadol's sons had a nickname, and Maccabee was the nickname for Yehuda. Why that is?
Is it a nickname or their Greek name?
Good question. I don't know. All right, and if it was a Greek name, then all of the kuf kuf discussions really are. I don't know. If I remember correctly, I didn't in my prep in these three chapters. I don't remember it being mentioned, but something seems to tell me that somewhere in the book it actually addresses it. That, you know, it might have been a post facto type of a thing, like Esau, yeah, being called Edom because of the Akin Karashma Edom, because he ate the red dish. And again, there are other reasons for him being called Edom also. Tanakh, right? And again, this isn't Tanakh, but you can pick up on the Tanakh style of writing here, because the way somebody is, somebody having a name and that becoming their identity is something that we're very familiar with. All right, already from this week's parsha with Esau being called Edom. Okay, so he has these sons. Everybody had a name. All right, read the footnotes in Goldstein. He actually addresses all of these different nicknames or you know, names that they were known by. And they said, right, they, it was verse 6, he saw the blasphemies being committed in Judah and Jerusalem and said, alas, why was I born to see this? Verse 7, the ruin of my people, the ruin of the holy city, and to dwell there when it was given over to the enemy, the sanctuary given over to aliens. 8, her temple has become like a man without honor. This language sound familiar to you? Where is it coming from? Yeah, this is some of this stuff is cut and paste. We don't have the original Hebrew, but some of the stuff in translation seems to be cut and paste right out of Eicha. Right? They actually are telling about another destruction of the Mikdash, even though it wasn't destroyed, it was just plundered. Okay? Her glorious vessels have been carried into captivity, her babes have been killed in her streets, her youths by the sword of the foe. One nation has not inherited her palaces and has not seized her spoils. We're the ramshackle joke of every nation in the world. All her adornment has been taken away. No longer free, she has become a slave. Right? This was about the dignity of Am Yisrael, of, you know, Bnei Yehuda, really, of the Judean peoples. 12. And behold, our holy place, our beauty, and our glory have been laid waste. The Gentiles have profaned it. 13. Why should we live any longer? And Matityahu and his sons rent their clothes. First they did. They did mourning and mourned greatly. Again, does this sound familiar to you? What's the allusion? Purim, Esther, exactly. They're mourning. Then the king's officers who were enforcing the apostasy came to the city of Modi'in to make them their sacrifice. Now I'm reading through this chapter because this is the scene that some of us may know. This is a relatively famous scene. This is where the scene is coming from. 16. And I guess we'll close with this. Many from Israel came to them, and Matityahu and his sons were assembled. Right? This is, right, you saw from chapter 1, Antiochus appointed these these officers who were there to make sure that his law was being enforced. All right, and they came along to Modi'in, and they said, 17, the officers came along, and they wanted to assemble people to do these sacrifices to Greek gods, to the pagan gods. 17, then the king's officers spoke to Matityahu, who was a local leader, and they said, you are a leader, honored and great in this city, and supported by sons and brothers. This is politically smart, trying to go after the leader so that people will follow him. Now, be the first to come and do what the king commands. as all the Gentiles and the men of Judah and those that are left in Jerusalem have done. You come along and you do what Antiochus said. Then you and your sons will be numbered among the friends of the king, and you and your sons will be honored with silver and gold and many gifts. Oh, to be the king's man, in the words of John Adams. Right? If only to be, if only to be the king's man, all I need to do is bend the knee at this point. But Matatiyahu answered and said in a loud voice, even if all the nations that lived under the rule of the king obey him, and have chosen to do his commandments, departing each one from the religion of his fathers, yet I and my sons and my brothers will live by the covenant of our fathers. Make Yehuda great again. 21. Far be it from us to desert the law and ordinances.
Yehuda, not his son.
What?
Yehuda, not his son.
We don't know anything about Yehuda yet. Only that his name is Maccabeus. Or that his name is Maccabee. 22. We will not obey the king's word by turning aside from our religion to the right hand or to the left. 23. When we had finished speaking these words, a Jew came forward in the sight of all to offer sacrifice upon the altar at Modiin, according to the king's command. When Matatiyahu saw it, he burned with zeal and his heart was stirred. What do you guys think? What is this? What is
Pinchas.
This? Pinchas. You're in for a Baruch Shekivant, you're in for a surprise. He gave vent to righteous anger. He ran and he killed him then and there upon the altar. 25. At the same time, he killed the king's officer, who was forcing them to sacrifice, and he tore down the altar. So he made a public showing of the defiance of the king here. At the same time, he killed the king. All right, 26. Thus he burned with zeal for the law. Here, at the end of 26, as Pinchas did against Zimri the son of Salu. All right? When Gaffney came to speak, at the seminar in Shiva, it was 8 years ago now. All right, he pointed to this verse. He says, "If you want evidence that the author of Maccabees was trying to put this book in Tanakh, you don't need to look further than this scene." He set up a scene exactly. I'm not saying it didn't happen, but the way it was written up, using the same language, exactly like Pinchas. Pinchas ben Elazar ben Aaron HaKohen, Shivat Chameitim Yom Bnei Israel. Right, Pinchas himself, and not only that, but it even invokes him. Okay, we're gonna close. We'll stop here today. Again, today was about setting up the historical background, getting a feel for the type of book that we're dealing with over here. Next week, what I want to do is I'm going to bring in. All right, I don't want to read through like straight text anymore. I wanted you to get a feel for it. Next week, not next week, in 2 weeks, what we're going to do is I'm going to take excerpts from both 1 and 2 Maccabees from throughout the whole books. We're going to get a good, healthy summary of the entire book. Again, it's very long. But we're going to get a good summary of the entire thing, and then we're going to go through the theories that are there in the scholarly literature as to why it was not entered, and the theory of my revered teacher, Dr. Lyman, which is basically, at this point, the accepted version. But Bezrat Hashem, we will continue with that, and hopefully at least not your classic introduction to Hanukkah, but I hope one that will enhance our celebration and understanding and appreciation of the holiday nonetheless. Thank you so much, and have a great, great day.